Robert Hay has been at the bar since 1992. He was admitted in 1988. He was a former solicitor at Allen's Arthur Robinson. He holds his honours degree from University of Tasmania in Hobart and a master's degree from Monash University. He's extraordinarily well qualified in the field under which we are campaigning this morning. He's the co-author with Clyde Croft, now Justice Croft, and Adrian Bradbrook of Commercial Tenancy Law, the third edition. He's the co-author, again with Clyde Croft, of the Loose Leaf Retail Leases Service of Victoria. He's also the co-author, again with Clyde Croft, I wonder what list he specialises in the Supreme Court, of the Mortgagee's Power of Sale. And he's also, Robert's also the case notes editor of the Property Law Journal. There's no indication there that you do that with Clyde Croft, Robert. He practices extensively, as you'd imagine, in retail, tenancy law and in property and commercial law generally. As with the previous speaker, I note, he was also in the Palace Entertainment Complex case. So it must have been replete with eminent counsel. Robert will, as I said earlier, his topic will be basically how to keep them out and not pay the rent, whereas the previous speaker was how to get in and get the rent. So I'll introduce Robert. Thank you very much.
I should just correct Tony. Mortgagee's Power of Sale is not yet published, so don't go looking for that. Now, I'll be dealing with relief against forfeiture. And, of course, the most common circumstance in which you'll find a tenant applying for relief is where a forfeiture has occurred under a proviso for re-entry that provides, upon the happening of certain events, the landlord can re-enter and forfeit the lease. Relief from forfeiture can be granted not only for non-payment of rent, for other covenants as well, but traditionally it was non-payment of rent, though in modern times equity has allowed relief from forfeiture for breach of covenants other than non-payment of rent. And of course statute has intervened with Section 146 of the Property Law Act. Now the paper that I've prepared is quite detailed and I won't be going through the paper, I'll just pick out some of the significant issues. Obviously the first major question is who can apply, and generally you'll find lessees, sub-lessees and mortgagees of leases applying for relief against forfeiture. The position of sub-lessees is particularly interesting. Apart from being able to seek relief against forfeiture of their own lease, that is the sublease, they can also seek relief against forfeiture of the head lease. So if the head landlord has re-entered and taken possession, that will end the subtenancy. The subtenant can apply for relief against forfeiture of the head lease. That in itself raises questions about whether the subtenant has to pay all the arrears in rent owing under the entirety of the head lease, that is in respect of all the property governed by the head lease, or only arrears in rent in respect of the area of the lease that is taken up with the sublease. Now, there are cases both way on that issue, but I just raise it and point out that it can be a concern. If you're acting for a subtenant and they want to get relief from forfeiture, you've got to think about whether you want to take over all the obligations under the head lease. Now, what are the implications of applying for relief against forfeiture? And this is surprisingly misunderstood by many people. You are throwing yourself at the mercy of the court. The tenant is admitting forfeiture. In other words, there is no lease anymore. You're saying, yes, I'm in breach, lease is gone, but it would be unconscionable for me not to get my lease back. Now, the traditional view where a party seeking relief against forfeiture is you can't make an alternative claim that, in fact, there was no breach and therefore no forfeiture. But judges in modern times have moved away from that. Occasionally, you'll still see a judge refer to the older law, but the modern cases tend to be going the other way. So you can have an alternative claim. One, I need relief against forfeiture. The other one, I've got a good claim that actually defeats the forfeiture. But if you do proceed with the relief against forfeiture and are successful, you cannot then turn around and claim damages against the landlord for re-entry. Now, that has happened here in Victoria. A tenant has tried to do that. You cannot do it. By seeking relief against forfeiture and the court saying, once you seek relief against forfeiture, the lease is over. That is it. Now, I've referred to these cases that I'm that I'm alluding to in the paper, so I won't go through them. So if possible, avoid making a relief against forfeiture claim with no other claim. If you can, try and construct a claim that will defeat the forfeiture. Now, there are a number of sources of power to grant relief against forfeiture, and again, most people only concentrate on Section 146 of the Property Law Act. That's the obvious starting point. A lessee may apply for relief where the lessor is proceeding by action or otherwise to enforce or has enforced a right of re-entry or forfeiture without the aid of the court. So if the court has granted the forfeiture or right to go in for the landlord, the tenant cannot use Section 146 of the Property Law Act. Sub-lessees, they apply under Section 1464 where the head lease has been forfeited. The Supreme Court also maintained its traditional equitable jurisdiction. Most people will try and avoid using that because the consequence of the Supreme Court just using its equitable jurisdiction is that a new lease has to come into play for reliefs given rather than just a revival of the old lease. So the statutory mechanisms for relief against forfeiture will revive the old lease. Equity will deem there to be a new lease. There's a significant provision in Section 79 of the Supreme Court Act, and that is where the rent is 6 months in arrears and the landlord has the right to re-enter for non-payment of rent, the tenant has up to 6 months after judgment to pay the arrears and all costs, and they can still make an application for relief against forfeiture. So that can be a very useful provision for a tenant that's been tardy or maybe hasn't had the money to pay. You've got up to 6 months to do something about it. So that gets you over the problem of Section 1462. You remember I said you can't use that if there's been a court order and the landlord's gone into possession under that court order. Section 85 of the Supreme Court Act enables the Supreme Court to give summary relief where a landlord's proceeding for forfeiture for non-payment of rent. So that's another provision. So, you know, you might end up going ahead under Section 146, but bear in mind there's these other provisions about as well. Now, where to go? Which court? VCAT or Supreme Court? Now, the answer to this question used to be easy. You automatically went to the Supreme Court or the County Court. Now, VCAT has complicated this situation. The problem's not that the Supreme Court has lost its jurisdiction to grant relief against forfeiture. It still has that jurisdiction. Of course, VCAT also has jurisdiction to grant relief against forfeiture. The question is, how far does VCAT's jurisdiction extend? Now, Sam's already mentioned that if the landlord's just claiming rent, VCAT doesn't have exclusive jurisdiction. But also, VCAT doesn't have exclusive jurisdiction for claims concerning unconscionable conduct and relief against forfeiture. So you can go to the Supreme Court. The actual definition of retail lease in the Retail Leases Act is not particularly wide. So the question that I'll be posing is to what extent can you run a case in VCAT that doesn't fall within the strict definition of retail premises lease in Section 4 of that Act? There's also another issue I'll be looking at. What happens if the tenant wants to apply for relief against forfeiture of the lease, but also make an alternative claim that there's been no breach? So, in this instance, about the two courts, what happens if the alternative claim is one that VCAT has exclusive jurisdiction for, and you run into the problem which Sam mentioned? The Supreme Court could hear the relief against forfeiture application, but it can't hear the alternative claim. Now, there's been some recent law on this, so I'll deal with that. Most tenants will want to bring their applications in VCAT because of the cost consequences. In VCAT, a tenant does not have to pay the landlord's costs on an application for relief against forfeiture. Now, Section 11 of the Retail Leases Act defines the type of leases to which that Act applies. Basically, and I'm paraphrasing it, it covers leases that under the terms of the lease relating to the premises, under the terms of the lease relating to the premises, are the premises used wholly or predominantly for the sale or hire of goods by retail or the retail provision of services. So can a dispute concerning a lease that doesn't fall strictly within those provisions, that section, be heard and determined in VCAT? Now, the answer to that is yes, because Part 10 of the Retail Leases Act contains all the dispute resolution provisions, and that significantly extends the leases to which the Act applies for the purposes of determining leasing disputes. The critical provision in Part 10 is the definition of retail tenancy dispute, which is in Section 81.1. In broad terms, a retail tenancies dispute is defined to mean a dispute between a landlord and a tenant arising under or in relation to retail premises to which the 2003 Act or its predecessors, that is the Retail Tenancies Reform Act 1998 or the Retail Tenancies Act 1986, apply or applied, and this is the significant one, and arising under a lease that provides for the occupation of retail premises in Victoria to which none of the acts apply. So if you have a lease, and it can be called a retail lease, retail premises lease, to which none of the acts apply, you can get into VCAT. Now, the breadth of those of the definition means that a substantial, well, I would think a majority of applications for relief against forfeiture can be heard in VCAT. Now, Justice Byrne, in a case called Victoria and Timbuk, that's also referred to in the paper, he confirmed the ambit of Part 10. It's much wider than the main provisions of the Retail Leases Act, much wider than just the definition of retail premises lease in Section 4. He also intriguingly raised the prospect whether the meaning of retail premises in Part 10 could extend to the common law definitions of retail premises. He didn't actually say that, but if you read it, that's what he appears to be alluding to. So it may be that you can actually look at case law concerning what retail premises mean and get the case into VCAT on that basis. In the Victorian Timbuk case, he was dealing with a lease that had been made in the 1960s, and there was a huge dispute in the Supreme Court about whether it should stay in the Supreme Court or in VCAT, and it was sent to VCAT, and the landlord had to pay all the costs of that application. Now, most tenants will be going to VCAT, as I've said, because Section 92 of the Retail Leases Act provides that each party in a proceeding before the tribunal is to bear its own costs, and costs is widely defined to include fees, charges and disbursements. This was highlighted in a case Jacques Nominees Proprietary Limited, the Jam Factory. In that case, the landlord sought a costs order against the party seeking relief against forfeiture. There was a clause in the lease that required the tenant to indemnify the landlord against all losses, damages and expenses which the landlord may sustain or incur arising from a breach of the lease. Standard form, standard clause. Deputy President McNamara held that Section 92 of the Act overrode the terms of the lease and the rule that an innocent landlord should be paid its costs as part of granting relief against forfeiture. In other words, the landlord got nothing. Obviously back rent was paid, but the landlord didn't get any costs or expenses. And they would have been substantial. In that case, they had Peter Bick and a senior junior who's now a silk. So it was expensive little exercise. By contrast, in the Supreme Court, a tenant will invariably have to pay all the landlord's costs of the application. That's one of the prices for, that's the price for the relief. Indeed, Section 80 of the Act, that's a Supreme Court Act, requires that the tenant pay all the costs as part of the price for relief where the tenant makes its application under Section 79 of the Supreme Court Act. I mentioned that to you earlier. That's the one that provides that if rent's been in arrears for 6 months, the tenant can still make an application. Now, this is an issue I've already raised. If the application for relief were made in the Supreme Court, it's questionable whether an alternative claim could also be heard and determined in the Supreme Court if that alternative claim falls within the definition of retail tenancy dispute in Part 10 of the Retail Leases Act. Because you might remember VCAT has exclusive jurisdiction to hear and determine retail tenancies disputes. Now, this issue arose in a Supreme Court case a couple of years ago now, Zhao and Perpetual Trustee Company, where the tenant applied to the Supreme Court for relief against forfeiture of an option to renew. That's an option to renew the lease. And also made claims in respect of which VCAT had exclusive jurisdiction. Now, Justice Vickery held that because the court had jurisdiction to hear and determine the relief against forfeiture claim, it had accrued jurisdiction to hear and determine the related claims. Now, in my decision, in my view, that decision's not correct, and it has been heavily criticised. And
with respect to his honour.
Yes, with respect to his honour. I mention this because it's quite possible that you might come up against Justice Croft in the Supreme Court if you made an application. Now, he's criticised that decision in Retail Leases Victoria, so you should bear that in mind. Well, I meant people making the application should bear in mind if they're... And this court seems to be allocating a lot of property law matters to Justice Croft, so it's quite possible you'll end up there. Basically, the point is Justice Vickery relied on some of the cases you might recall when there was all that dispute about whether the federal court had jurisdiction to hear corporation law cases, quite a few years ago now, and the accrued jurisdiction issue arose in those cases. And Justice Croft in Retail Leases Victoria makes a good job of distinguishing all those cases and saying they shouldn't have been relevant to this case. Now, my paper sets out in detail all the relevant principles for seeking relief against forfeiture, and I don't propose to go through those because basically the court has a really wide discretion to grant relief against forfeiture. So I'll be dealing with some of the practical issues that can arise. From my point of view, speed is essential, and this is something that's often ignored. The most difficult situation is where speed from the tenant's approach here. Most difficult situation is where you have a client who approaches you only after a landlord has re-entered possession or after a time period has expired and they've been served with a notice terminating the lease. Now, what happens then? The landlord, will assume for the purposes of this, has gone into possession. Your client's a nightclub owner. This is the case I had last year. It's a Thursday, the landlord's gone into possession Thursday afternoon. Your client's biggest night of the week is Friday night. What do you do? The lease is over. Didn't comply with a default notice. So what can you do? It's an interesting situation because why should the court let you back in? On what basis would it let you back in? There's no lease. You haven't shown that you've got a right to relief against forfeiture. An injunction's intended to preserve the status quo, and the status quo is that there's no lease. Well, fortunately, the New South Wales courts have taken a very sensible approach and decided that, well, they didn't decide, that was the law, but they've applied this quite freely, that the tenant has an equity to revive its lease, and in order to protect that equity, the tenant should be let back into possession in appropriate circumstances. Now, it's very important to act quickly because the landlord may have another tenant waiting to take up the lease, to move in. Once that happens, basically, you can forget your relief against forfeiture application. The court will not grant relief that are going to prejudice third-party rights. Also, acting promptly really can deflate a landlord. Normally, they're on a bit of a high once they've gone back in. I've got rid of that bastard. You know, I can now get on with my life and get someone else in here. You get back in, they start... And I've seen this happen. The whole dynamic changes. Now, there's a couple of wonderful cases in Sydney which I refer to in the back page 18 of the paper. The heading is Tenant Lawyer's Checklist. There's a couple of cases called Solowave and Sufigo which set out what you have to do to get back in. Basically, you have to show you've got an arguable case for relief against forfeiture. You've got to give an undertaking, you'll pay the rent, the back rent, and the court will let you back in pending your application for relief against forfeiture. In VCAT, as most of you would be aware and Sam mentioned, you need to get a certificate from the Small Business Commissioner before you can commence a proceeding in VCAT. Well, that doesn't apply to injunctions, so you don't need to worry about that if you go and get an injunction in VCAT. I should add that, from my experience, the members of VCAT are not familiar with this type of application. That is, once the landlord's already gone into possession, you'll have to convince them that they can do it, that they can tell the landlord to get out of possession and let you back in. But they will do it. Senior Member Davis did it in a recent case that I was involved in. Now, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the price for the injunction will be payment of the back rent. Now, I'll deal later more with this, but Think flexibly when you're doing this. Courts are willing to mould remedies to help you out. So it doesn't necessarily mean you have to pay the rent the day you go in. You could argue that, in the example I gave, the rent should be paid on the Monday. Big night of trading Friday, big night of trading Saturday, probably trading Sunday for a lot of nightclubs. Courts are willing to do that. But you've got to convince the court that the landlord will be paid. In fact, there's some remarkable orders that courts have made, and I'll come to those later. Now, once you've got your injunction, we'll assume you get it here, the power balance changes dramatically, and it's a good time to ask the court or tribunal to order an urgent mediation. In VCAT, that's very simple, because the landlord will be feeling deflated, and if the reason for the forfeiture was non-payment of rent, the tenant has a very high chance of obtaining relief against forfeiture. And it's the landlord's legal advisors will be saying to the landlord, if they can show they can pay the back rent and pay the rent in future, they'll get back in. So you want an urgent mediation before the return date of the application for relief against forfeiture. Now, on that point about why the court will let you back in, I should say, where the only breach is non-payment of rent, the application is invariably granted upon payment of arrears and the landlord's costs and expenses. Obviously, costs and expenses doesn't apply in VCAT. They'll let you back in except in exceptional circumstances. And the reason why that is that the right of forfeiture is treated as being just a security for payment of the rent. Once the rent's paid, there's no reason to have the lease forfeited. Exceptional circumstances usually mean consistently lengthy defaults, which may lead to the inference that even if relief is given, there'll be another breach very soon. Now, I've mentioned all the major cases in the paper. There's Platt and Ong. There's a whole series of them. They're all mentioned there, so if you want to have a good look at those, they'll give you the principles very quickly. Now, if you're acting for the tenant and you're having to draft affidavits seeking relief from forfeiture, relief against forfeiture, you've got to bear in mind that you're throwing yourself at the mercy of the court. Too often you see affidavits where an aggressive approach is taken, an attempt to explain things away, not really addressing the issues. The fact is, you have to persuade a judge or a VCAT member why they should indulge you and let you back in at potentially the landlord's inconvenience. The lease is at an end. You've got to come with clean hands, don't hide things, make appropriate concessions, be contrite. Won't happen again. This is how we're going to stop it happening next time. As much information as should be provided as possible. Don't be evasive. It's very counterproductive to be aggressive. I mean, one thing the landlord might be alleging against you, against your client, is that this has been a willful default, and that certainly is a ground not to grant relief against forfeiture. So if you take a very aggressive approach in the affidavit, that will just play into the landlord's hands. The affidavit should explain why breaches occurred and what steps have been taken to ensure they won't happen again. Also, to colour things, you know, the judge is a human being, you want them to be sympathetic. Say how much money's been spent on improving the premises, how many employees you've got, how many employees the tenant's got. That all will play significantly into the decision. From the landlord's point of view, the tenant's affidavit should be scrutinised carefully to assess whether it's worthwhile opposing the application. As I said earlier, if you form the view that the application's likely to be granted, it's a very good time to start negotiating, because through negotiation you might be able to get the landlord's costs paid, and in my experience that often happens. The tenant, rather than taking the risk of having the court or VCAT say, we're not going to give you relief against forfeiture, as part of a deal, we'll agree to pay the landlord's costs. Well, of course, if the case proceeds in VCAT, no costs. Also, it's very common for the tenant's affidavits to make assertions rather than actually provide any evidence about anything. So normally assertions about financial capability, that's the main issue. Don't allow assertions to go by. Demand to see tax returns, financial records, and what have you. You may, you know, your counsel may have to cross-examine too if you think that the tenant's not being forthcoming. And the tribunal won't like it if they just make assertions and don't go any further, particularly if you've challenged them to produce the records. Now, I mentioned this earlier, the court and VCAT has an absolute discretion as to whether or not to grant relief, and they can be very inventive in the orders that they make in granting relief, to the extent that they're sometimes accused of rewriting a lease. There's, I'll just refer to a Sydney decision here, Melksham and Archerfield Airport Corporation, and I haven't mentioned this in the paper, it's 2004 ANZ Conveyancing Reports 363, where relief against forfeiture was granted to a lessee that purported to sublease the premises in breach of a covenant precluding subleasing without the landlord's consent. So, blatant breach, sublease without the landlord's consent. Justice Holmes stated that he would impose, the actual conditions he imposed are not recorded in the judgment, but he said what he was going to do. Justice Holmes stated that he would impose conditions that at a minimum required the applicant for relief to do what was required to obtain the landlord's consent to the sublease. He said that it may be necessary to, quote, factor in the possibility of further relief being sought against an unreasonable withholding of consent, and to require that if such consent is not ultimately forthcoming, the applicants retake possession of the premises from the second respondent. So he's saying if the consent was not ultimately forthcoming, he might allow the landlord to re-enter possession as against the sublease who are wrongfully there. There's a legendary Victorian case, Re Automotive and General Industries Lease, which is an unreported decision of Justice Adam in the 1970s, which you can find in the Supreme Court, where he did rewrite the lease because the order that he imposed was that the lessor's approval or permission in relation to two covenants that had been breached should not be unreasonably withheld. Now, the lease didn't have anything about unreasonably withholding consent to doing the things that the tenant was in breach about. So by seeking the mercy of the court, he was in a better position than he would have been if he hadn't committed a breach at all. Now, I actually have a copy of that case if anyone wants it, and I don't refer to that in the paper either. It took me a while to find it. But it is often referred to, but I was not certain it actually existed. where orders are made for things to be done in a certain way, say repairs, the court can extend the time. So if you're acting for the tenant and you find you can't comply with the order, the court will extend the time on a proper application with an explanation as to why you can't comply with the court's timetable. Also, the courts will not necessarily insist on an immediate rectification. I mean, I've read some cases recently, there's a famous one, Westminster and Swinton, which is an English case, where the tenant was given 2 years to effect repairs to a house and put it back in the state it was in, and before they'd changed it. So it's not unusual for that to happen. Provided the landlord can be protected and will get ultimately back what it wants and what's it entitled to under the lease, the court will mould the remedy. And you'll probably find here, I think, that the Supreme Court judges might be actually a bit more helpful than VCAT because they're more familiar with this. If you're going to VCAT, you'll really need to have lots of authorities on when you're arguing these kind of points, these harder ones, about why it shouldn't be immediate, why the rectification or what have you shouldn't be immediate. But if you're in front of, say, any Supreme Court judge that does any property law work, they will accept that because they'll already know about this. There's a famous case in Victoria, Platt and Ong. This is a case that Justice Gillard heard, not the current Justice Gillard, the previous one. The tenant was in arrears of rent. Yes, it's his father. The tenant was in arrears of rent and had breached a covenant not to erect signs and the premises on the premises and a covenant not to annoy another tenant, the annoyance being leaving a door open in the kitchen that disclosed an untidy and uninviting appearance to neighbours and passers-by. Now, the complaints were upheld. The judge says, yes, there's been a breach. The tenant sought relief against forfeiture and the landlord sought an order for possession. The tenant was given 7 days to pay the rent. So again, there was an indulgence there. The tenant was still in possession, so it didn't need to get back in possession, but it was given 7 days to pay. Now in VCAT, they generally require you to pay immediately. So you'll need to take cases along like Platt and Ong to say, well, we don't have to do that. They was given 7 days to remove signs that had been put in place and 60 days to insert a screen across the doorway of the kitchen to hide its interior in the event that the door was left open. And 60 days to pay the landlord's costs. The landlord's claim for possession was then adjourned and it would come on again for hearing if, in fact, the tenant didn't comply with all the conditions of the relief against forfeiture. Now, how long have I been?
You've got five.
Oh, well, I'll finish there.
Good.
I just wanted to mention there's also...
No, I don't mean that majority of sense.
I just wanted to mention that in the paper I do deal with this issue that's emerging about whether you can get relief for forfeiture, relief against forfeiture for failure to renew an option on time. There are a number of cases now on that. They're mentioned in paragraph 33 of the paper. The whole idea is still highly questionable, and if you go to court with that, you can't actually say it's happened yet. The judges, two judges have said yes, it can happen, but it hasn't actually happened. There hasn't been a judgment to that effect, and there's also conceptual difficulties with the whole idea. Thank you.
I want to thank Robert and Sam for their excellent works and presentations, both from a legal and a factual perspective, and indeed a practical perspective. What we should now do, and I wasn't meaning to cut Robert short, but I think his paper had so many issues that it justifies at least 10 minutes of questions for people to get him to explicate further on some of the issues that are contained within his paper and within his talk. So I seek questions from the floor.
Courts love trying to work that one out. Basically, it's saying, up you landlord, I'm not paying. Right? Just deliberately not paying. Exploiting the fact that you, the landlord might be away, or you know the landlord's timid and just refusing to pay. Just exploiting the situation. There might be, the landlord might not be a person that likes any legal proceedings, but if you just say, I'm not going to pay, or it probably arises more in situations where changes are made to the premises without the landlord's consent. But the landlord has said, don't you do that, and you go and knock a wall down. That's a willful breach. Now, courts don't like that. Now, we're dealing with equitable principles here. I probably didn't stress that enough. So if you're seeking equity, you've got to do equity. And they look at what party's behaviour has been along the line. And if your behaviour has been appalling, it's a good reason not to give you relief. But the court sets a pretty high standard, I tell you. I read some cases where the tenants had acted pretty badly. In fact, there's a decision of Deputy President McNamara recently where he said the tenant is clearly trying to cause trouble for the landlord. He basically went that far, but he still granted relief.
Questions? Further questions? Yes? Back?
We were recently acting for a tenant who had entered into a lease after making some preliminary inquiries, thinking that the premises would be suitable for them. Very shortly after signing the lease, realised that it was, despite those preliminary inquiries, the Council of Water wouldn't let them use it for that purpose. They tried everything to be able to make it work. They sort of begged the landlord for forgiveness and tried to offer reasonable costs. The landlord wouldn't let them out without paying a full year's rental. Do you think if we had pushed it to the point of VCAT, is VCAT able to look at equitable principles and perhaps say if that was too harsh a penalty? Is that something that they're able to consider?
Well, in your situation, it's not the landlord's problem. The landlord is under no obligation to ensure that your premises are suitable for use. Even if the lease says the permitted use is X, that is not a warranty that the premises are suitable for X.
Yeah, we just got an idea it was a very, very harsh penalty, given they've never had access, at least haven't commenced yet. For the sake of 1 week of signing a document, do you think that VCAT is able to consider the circumstances?
Well, VCAT can alter the terms of a lease, and as you can under the Fair Trading Act in VCAT, where the landlord has acted unconscionably, but there's nothing really unconscionable about that. It's just unfortunate.
So there's nothing they can do in those circumstances?
No. The landlord, in fact, could have done nothing and just demanded that you pay the rent for the whole period of the lease and sat back and done nothing and just sued you every time. Or the landlord can re-enter and then sue you for the loss of the bargain. And that's where you had to make your assessment, really. What would the loss be? I mean, if you knew there were lots of tenants about, the loss might be negligible.
Further questions?
Questions from the floor? Yes.
You said that if the landlord finds another tenant, the whole business of relief is gone. Can the tenant therefore manipulate to find, for example, in your nightclub case, if I can get somebody in on the Friday to take the Friday's trade, etc., is that going to ruin the whole case for the...
You mean can the landlord
manipulate? Yes.
Well, landlords try and engineer these things, and that's why I stress the importance of relief, of being speedy. In the case that I mentioned about the nightclub, the landlord had entered into negotiations with someone else in advance because my client had been a bad payer. So it was going to be, there was likely to be a breach again. So he entered into negotiations with someone else, said to that someone else, they're in breach now, we'll get rid of them and we'll sign up with you. But we, because we got back in there straight away, that stopped all that. You can also get an injunction to stop negotiations between them negotiating with third parties, but that's a bit harder.
Yes.
Where a tenant fails to exercise an option under the lease, you know, whether you've got an artist or not, and you have to choose a venue, would you choose the Supreme Court or VCAT? Would you see...
Again, this is really based on my knowledge of some of the Supreme Court judges. I might well go to VCAT because I know two Supreme Court judges, that's Justice Hollingworth and Vickery, have said you, conceptually you can seek relief against forfeiture for failing to exercise an option. But I do know that, say, again, Justice Croft, in his writings, has criticised that view. Now, I think in VCAT, they're more likely to just look at the two cases, one of them being called Beamer, and I mentioned these in the paper, Beamer and Zhao, and say, well, two Supreme Court judges have said yes, we'll allow it. But, you know, if you went to the Supreme Court, you might meet Justice Croft, and he might not agree, because conceptually it's difficult. Traditionally in Victoria, an option to renew is characterised as an offer by the landlord to renew, which he can't withdraw while the option remains exercisable. Now, the option has ceased to be exercisable, so what are we seeking relief against forfeiture? What is being relieved? The landlord, there's nothing to relieve. And there's a full court decision in Victoria, B.S. Stillwell, that analyses what an option is. Now, that doesn't seem to have been properly explored in some of the cases.
Are you saying there is no jurisdiction in VCAT to grant relief against failure to exercise an option?
No. I'm saying I think you probably do better there because they will see that there's two judges, Justice Hollingworth and Vickery, in different cases, have both said, yes, you can get relief against forfeiture for failure to exercise an option. Now, in VCAT, they will just say, well, that's the law. But you get a judge in the Supreme Court, he or she will go over the whole thing again and analyse it very carefully.
You get a different result.
You could. So I would actually bring that in VCAT, and then if it's appealed, so be it. But a lot of these things are not appealed because it's too costly to appeal.
What normally do you have to prove to get relief?
Pardon?
What normally do you have to prove to get relief?
Well,
as
you
a
have
tenant.
As a tenant, that you can pay when you're dealing with rent, that you can pay the rent, arrears, and you'll have to pay it reasonably.
I'm talking about failure to exercise the option.
Oh well, that's all unexplored. You'd have to explain the circumstances. How that occurred.
I forgot.
Well, that's probably a reason, yes. You know, it's a different situation if the landlord's misled you. You don't even need to rely on these type of principles for relief against forfeiture. There'd be an estoppel and all the other things. But if the landlord's done nothing wrong, then you're forced back to these arguments about getting relief against forfeiture.
Okay, that's the witching hour, 9:00. Can I just say in passing, in concluding, I respectfully disagree with Robert on that last answer to your question. Knowing the quality of the VCAT members as compared to the Supreme Court members, my first port of call in that sort of case would probably be the practice court of the Supreme Court, or if it's in a specialised list, into that list. The really good member of VCAT was Michael McNamara, who in my view has the same intellect and analysis as any Supreme Court judge I know, but I think he's now ceased He's now ceased in that list, which is a great shame. I'm not sure. What's he gone into? Oh, I see. Well, he's now going to be supervising us. The other difficulty with VCAT is that it's more likely you get down there, particularly in an urgent application, and they haven't got someone either in that list or prominent in that list to deal with it. And you might get a member, as you alluded to in respect of the Supreme Court, you may not get Hollingworth or Vickery. They're both very good judges, I might say. But Croft is better in this area, more specialised knowledge. But the general quality in the Supreme Court, obviously, born of their years at the bar or in the profession specialising in these areas, is higher. And at VCAT, it is more of an unknown quantity. But that's just a difference of opinion that Robert and I have on that. I respect his opinion as being a good one. It highlights, I think, the main issue that's been raised today for us all, and that is the issue of the introduction of VCAT in 2003 into this field. It's a difficult field. It's probably one of the most difficult fields of law. And you now have the second overlay. You've got VCAT and the Supreme Court, and the government of whichever persuasion has introduced VCAT into the field as a means of reducing cost and complexity. In fact, it's merely added to it, in my view, because you've now got an overlap. Neither has been excluded. They're both parallel. If one were doing it to the exclusion of the other, that would be okay. But you've got these issues that you've all raised in your questions this morning that are clearly ongoing. And it's being a minefield, it's a gold mine for lawyers. And one might say cynically, so long may it be. But that's the real issue that's arisen today. And it's been, in my view, very well explained and presented both by Sam and Robert. And I'd ask you to put your hands together and again, thank them for their presentation.